Well, it's a very great privilege to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Joan Centrella. I'm happy to say that she has a PhD from Cambridge. However, she is from across the pond and is now chief of the Gravitational Astrophysics Laboratory at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. She's recently been awarded a very prestigious prize, the NASA Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal, for her work on modeling the gravitational effects of interacting black holes. So I think we're in for an exciting talk on binary black holes and gravitational waves, opening new windows onto the universe. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you very much. And, excuse me. It's a great pleasure to be here, to be able to share the excitement of this field as it's emerging, opening new windows onto the universe, and the new scientific discoveries that have come forth over the last couple of years. And it's a particular pleasure to be able to share this with the Christian family. Before I get going, since I'm a civil servant, I need to have this disclaimer that the words I speak here are my own and are not necessarily those of NASA and the U.S. government. I'm not going to comment on that. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to start with a little bit of motivation about what a gravitational wave is. Then I'm going to explain to you, and very briefly, how we think we may be able to detect these signals. Very first time we will actually be able to detect them directly. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about how gravitational waves are generated, what the astrophysical sources of these waves would be, and then why we need to calculate the merger of these black holes and how we do that on a computer. I'll pause within that for some reflections, personal reflections on my role in this work and being a Christian in this work, and then we'll just conclude with some of the new developments. So gravitational waves are usually said to be ripples in the curvature of space-time. Now, John magnificently described to you some about general relativity, and one of general relativity's key predictions is the existence of gravitational waves. Gravitational waves travel at the velocity of light and come about when you have masses moving in a way in which technically, in which the quadrupole moment changes, but you don't need to worry about that. You just need to think about masses moving, and typically a binary system will produce gravitational waves. So here, let's see, this is a little animation of gravitational waves, and down at the center you would imagine that there's a source of black holes down there merging together. And then out come, when they merge together, out come the gravitational waves from this process. There we go. Ripples in the curvature of space-time. Now, I'm going to tell you that I've had that movie for some time. That is an animation. That means we paid graphic artists to make that look pretty, just like Walt Disney does. I'm going to tell you that we can actually do that for real on the computer, and I'm going to show you what it really looks like in a few moments. Now, gravitational waves, as I said, are a prediction of general relativity, and in fact, we have excellent reason to believe that they do exist. We have very good indirect evidence for the existence of gravitational waves. This is in the form of what we call the Hulse-Taylor binary pulsar. Now, a pulsar is the remnant of a very old, massive star. It sheds its outer envelope in a supernova, and what's left over is a very, very dense core, maybe 10 kilometers in radius, having a mass of maybe 1.5 to 2 times the mass of the sun. So this thing is really very densely packed. Its density is nuclear. We have good reason to think that these things exist in the universe. And in 1974, Joe Taylor and his graduate student, Russell Hulse, found one of these systems, a neutron star, in orbit about another neutron star. Now, this was not just any old neutron star, though. It was, in fact, a pulsar. And a pulsar is a neutron star that has is very strongly magnetized, and charged particles around that magnetized neutron star spiral down onto the pole and are shot out in a beam of intense electromagnetic radiation. So I'm going to do a little improvisation here. This is a, I hope you can all see this. This is a this is the magnetic axis of the neutron star, and out come the pulses. But this thing is spinning, so when it goes around, round and round, if you are in the beam, the path of the beam of that pulsar, you will see an electromagnetic blip, blip, blip. And of course, these things were discovered back in the early 60s by Bell and Hewish. And in fact, they were originally thought to be little green men, later discovered to be pulsars. So we've known, and that was a Nobel Prize for that discovery as well. In the 1970s, Taylor and Hulse discovered a pulsar in a binary system. And that proved to be a very, very powerful discovery, because when you have that pulsar in a binary system, pulsars are very, very accurate clocks, extremely accurate clocks. And now that clock is going around in a binary system, like this. And so when it's coming towards you, blue shifting. Going away from you, red shifting. And by tracking the changes to the pulse shape due to the Doppler shift, they were able to map out the orbits and thus the dynamics, and get the dynamics of this system to exquisitely high precision. Now, general relativity predicts that when a system such as this is evolving, it will emit ripples in the curvature of space-time. And those ripples in the curvature of space-time carry energy and momentum away from the system. You take energy away from the binary, and it gets shrinks. It gets closer, closer, closer. So you should be able to see that, because you can map the orbit by this pulsar. You should be able to see the change in the orbit due to the emission of gravitational waves. And exactly that is what is shown here on this graph. This is actually the periastron shift, but it's the same sort of thing. This line here is the prediction of general relativity, and those little dots, like beads on a wire, are the observations. So this sealed the case for most people. This is what general relativity predicts gravitational waves will do to the system. This is what we see. The Nobel Prize was awarded in 1993. But yet, this is still indirect observation. We have not actually had a detector. A gravitational wave detection, direct detection, means we have a detector, in come the waves, the waves act on the detector in a predictable way, and we can make a measurement and confirm it. That's a direct detection, and that's what we want to do now. When we have these gravitational wave detectors, we will then be able to see the universe in terms of the gravitational waves that are bathing us constantly from all of these binary star sources and other sources out in the universe. And thereby, it will open a fundamental new window onto the universe, much the way that radio astronomy, gamma ray, X-ray astronomy did in the 20th century. So, how do you detect a gravitational wave? Well, gravitational waves cause matter to shear and strain in a particular way. So I'm going to give you, this is a cartoon, what we call the cartoon approximation of how a gravitational wave works. I'm a theoretician, and this is my working model of it. If you had an experimentalist up here, you would find that it's not quite exactly as simple as this, but it is, it does demonstrate, in fact, the basic principles. Imagine that you've got a detector of some length. Now here I'm going to look at a detector in the form of a ring of test particles. What does that mean? A ring of test particles means we've got some masses that are very, very small. They're not self-gravitating in the sense that they're not big enough to pull each other with their own gravitational fields. They're just sitting there in space-time in a circle. Now these yellow lines are meant, so those are the red dots. The yellow lines are meant to guide your eye. There's no wire there. They're just to guide your eye to show you what the pattern of these particles is. And when a gravitational wave comes in, through, it comes in like that, into the plane of the screen, what does it do to these test particles? It causes them to move in this direction. That's called the plus polarization. And it also causes a cross polarization here. There's two polarization states like that. So gravitational waves are going to cause matter to move in a particular way. Now down here is a schematic. Let's turn that off and that one off. Down here is a schematic of a laser interferometer gravitational wave detector, which is the way that we build these things these days. So right here is a laser. It comes in here. This is a beam-splitting mirror. Laser hits the mirror, breaks the beam into two pieces, shoots one that direction, one that direction. Okay, the mirror goes, the waves go here. So this is a test mass, and that's a test mass. When the gravitational wave comes, it's going to change the positions of those masses relative to the center, the beam splitter. Okay, and here is, you can see that the wave comes in. This is the plus polarization. It causes that change. It causes that change. Okay, so it's easy. You set up an interferometer, and the wave comes along, and it moves the mirrors. By how much does it move the mirrors? Well, 1 part in 10 to the 21 or smaller. In 10 to the 21 is what happens if you get your source very, very close, like in the Virgo cluster. Okay, so this is a, these are called precision measurements. And Yes, yes. And NASA, when I'll show you in a moment that we're going to be doing this from space. In fact, we're doing it on the ground already. We're going to be doing this from space in the future. And the engineers have a term called picophobia. That's what you have to measure in the picometer regime. But believe it or not, this has actually been achieved. We now have on the ground-based gravitational wave detectors. These are laser interferometers. So it's like that little schematic I showed you. These are two of them. There are several in the world. This is the LIGO Louisiana site. So down here is your main housing, and in there is the beam splitter. This is a vacuum tube. I'm trying to do this on the computer. It's a vacuum tube out here, 4 kilometers long with a mirror at the end. And you shoot a light back down there, measure that distance, and then on the other arm, down here, there's another mirror at the end of that arm, 4 kilometers. Again, very, very exquisite vacuum tube, because, you know, these are precision measurements. So stray molecules of air will cause a fake signal moving on those mirrors that's greater than the signal we have to measure. I mean, this is a very, very precision measurement. You know, the Louisiana site is Livingston, Louisiana. Underneath the site runs a Shell oil pipeline from the Gulf. When there is turbulence in the pipeline, they see it on their detectors. They call up Shell and say, "Did you know you've got turbulence in your pipeline? Thank you very much. It costs us money." So this is LIGO. This is Virgo. This is the French, the Italian-French system. This is in Pisa, Italy. There's also a British-German collaboration called GEO 600, which has been operating. LIGO and GEO are operating together. They've been taking data now for over a year, operating at design sensitivity. Virgo, I think, is just getting going. Sources for ground-based detectors are high-frequency gravitational waves. High frequency for us is going to mean binary systems composed of stellar objects, stellar remnants, black holes that result from the ends of stars' lives or possibly neutron stars. Now, the thing about gravitational waves is that I said that ground-based detectors look at high-frequency gravitational waves, so 10 hertz up to maybe 1,000 to 10,000 hertz, so a kilohertz or so. That's the range, the band of frequency sensitivity for LIGO and GEO and Virgo. To go below 10 hertz is very, very difficult. And in fact, we cannot go below 1 hertz at all on the surface of the Earth because there is seismic noise in the crust of the Earth which you cannot shield against. And so if you want to get down to low-frequency gravitational waves, you have to do that in space. And that's where NASA and ESA, in fact, European Space Agency, come in. Turns out that there are lots of interesting sources of gravitational waves. In fact, some of the strongest sources of gravitational waves are in the millihertz and regime and below in terms of frequency. They cannot, in principle, be observed from the Earth in gravitational waves. You have to do it from space. So hence LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. So this, again, is an interferometer system, but composed of 3 spacecraft. These spacecraft the spacecraft themselves are about like this. They're not that big. And each one of them has a Y tube and a laser beam going that way and a laser beam going that way. And they communicate in a triangular formation by measuring the distance between these spacecraft. Again, this is a cartoon approximation. This is very, very difficult to do. These things are all moving and there's a drift and all that. You have to compensate for all those things. But basically, they're measuring the change in the distance between the spacecraft over an arm length of 5 million kilometers. Now this system, here's a little movie of that. Here's the Earth, there's the Sun, and this is LISA, not to scale. But the spacecraft are like this. I am a theorist, but I do know that. And the constellation, there's 3 spacecraft, each in an independent orbit, and it rotates around. It's at 60 degrees to the ecliptic. The ecliptic's the plane of the Sun and Earth, the solar system plane. And it rotates around, and the reason it's at that orientation is it allows you to do triangulation on the sky through the course of a year's orbit, and that is how you find where the source is on the sky. It's very important for the functioning of LISA. The sources here are in the millihertz band, basically 10 to the minus 4 up to 1 hertz. Typical sources are massive black hole binaries. And as I said, this is a mission that's in formulation. It's a partnership between NASA and the European Space Agency. And the British have a very big and important role in this, as a matter of fact. Okay, so that's a little bit of an introduction on how we're going to detect these things. Ground-based operating already, LISA to come in the future. Now, sources. Black hole binaries, it turns out, are very strong sources of gravitational waves. So now a little interlude here on the sources of the gravitational waves and the black hole binaries. Massive black hole binaries, I'm going to start with the massive situation. The massive black hole binaries, we now believe that at the center of virtually every galaxy in the universe, there lurks a massive black hole. This is a scientific understanding that's was predicted by, as far as I know, Martin Rees is always ahead of his time, back in the 70s. But it was really nailed down by observation starting in the 1980s, but since the 1990s, since Hubble has been up there, there has been sighting after sighting after sighting. Every time we look for a black hole in the center of a galaxy, we find one. And what I mean by that is that we make a model of what the center of a galaxy should look like if there is a black hole in that and it matches the observations. There is excellent evidence that the galaxies have black holes, massive black holes, 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 9 solar masses worth of black holeness in the center of our galaxy. I'm not going to get into million billion because I know we don't all agree on what that means. I get tripped up with that myself. So 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9. Now these were first found in active galaxies, quasars, and here we see, this is a famous one, M87 is a galaxy. There's the center of the galaxy, and out of this thing, look at the scale, 4,000 light years. Out of this thing is coming a jet. Zoom in. Okay, this is 2,000 light year scale. That's the nucleus, and out of this thing comes a jet. Zoom down in. This is a tenth of a light year, and here is believed to be the nucleus of that galaxy in here and the jet coming out. We see these things, these huge jets all over the universe, active galaxies, known for many years by radio astronomy. We now believe the central engine of this is, in fact, a black hole. But not just active galaxies have black holes in them. This is the Milky Way, the center of the Milky Way. And down in here is a black hole, believed to be a black hole, of I think it's 4.2 or 4.3 million, 10 to the 6, solar masses. How do we know that? Well, various groups have mapped the orbits of stars around the center of the Milky Way galaxy for now more than a decade. The orbits of those stars match what would happen if they were in the gravitational presence of a black hole. The evidence is very, very strong. Now, another thing that we've learned over the past decade or so is that galaxies merge throughout cosmic history. And in fact, we believe that every galaxy has merged at least once in its lifetime. Here is an example of a galaxy, a famous galaxy pair known as the Antennae Galaxy. Here's a wide field picture of it, and this now over here is zooming down into the center. These two galaxies are coming together. Galaxies have gas in them. When they come together, the gas collides, produces shock waves, produces heating, little lumps form, and they get a lot of star formation. And so indeed, you're seeing a lot of star formation here down in these merging galaxies. And here, over here is a nice little simulation by John Dubinsky from CETA, from Toronto, about how this might have happened. Ooh. Cute. So a lot of people simulate the formation of merging the galaxy merger process, and this is just one example of how the Antennae Galaxy, also called the MICE, might have come about. So, each galaxy has a black hole in the center. Galaxies merge. When galaxies merge, we get massive black hole binaries. So massive black hole binaries, what's the evidence for that? Well, these are harder to find evidence for because black holes are very, very small. And they're black, meaning that they don't emit. I mean, we know that at the quantum level they emit Hawking radiation, but these big black holes, the Hawking radiation is not anywhere near the visible spectrum. It's very, very weak. So for all intents and purposes, these are classical objects, and they don't emit anything. What happens, however, is that if there's gas around them, it heats the gas up. The gravity of the black holes heats the gas up, and the gas emits electromagnetic waves, and we see that. So we have to look for these things. They're small. Very difficult to see them if they're close together. There are some pairs, however, that we can see. This is Abel 400. It's a quasar. It is a quasar. And down in here, this is the radio image. The big blue one is the radio image. You can see it's got some jet tails out there. You zoom down in. This is a Chandra X-ray image, and these are the two nuclei. Separation, 25,000 light years. These are not in orbit about each other. They're just coming together. But it's an example of a black hole pair. Here's another one. This is down here. It's NGC 6240. We give the NGC is New General Catalog 6240. That's the item, the SKU number if you're ordering from Sears or something like that. We give all these items in order to keep track of them. We have catalogs and we give them numbers, and we all this name could be Susanna, for all I know, but we call it NGC 6240. So here, this is again a Chandra. This is an X-ray image. And you can see this is an emerging galaxy. We know that this is in the center of a galaxy that's merging. It's very obvious in the optical. Down at the X-rays, you can see two nuclei. And if you zoom in the X-rays, you will see the two nuclei there. These are emitting X-rays consistent with black hole masses of 10 to the 7 solar masses. They are separated only by 3,000 light years, which in astronomical terms is pretty small. But not as small as this one. So this one was discovered just about a year ago. This is, again, got a funny number here. This has a separation. These are the two black hole nuclei here. And this has a separation of only 24 light years. So as more and more we look, we're seeing closer and closer black hole pairs. But to see the really, really small, the really close ones, we're going to have to see them in gravitational waves because we don't have the resolution in the electromagnetic instruments. And as I'll show you later on, when they emit gravitational waves, there's a very distinct pattern. And we learned a lot of new science, a lot of new physics and astronomy. But this is just to give you an idea. We do have we have good evidence to think that there are massive black hole binaries in the galaxy, in the universe. And how many per year will LISA see? Estimates range from 0.1 to about 300 per year. So we don't know exactly. Most of the people in the field think we're going to see about a dozen or so mergers per year. But again, so the observations are going to constrain the theories, which is how we like to do science. Now, that's the massive black hole story, and those are going to be sources for the space instruments like LISA. What about the ground-based instruments? Well, there are also smaller black holes in the universe, and they also form binaries. So intermediate mass black holes here, these are masses of maybe 100 or 1,000 or so times the mass of the sun. These are typically found within galaxies, and some of them are identified with these ULXs, or ultra-luminous X-ray sources. So here's a galaxy, beautiful grand design spiral, and these little red dots are ULXs. And people have modeled what those ULXs, what they contain, what's down in there. And they're consistent, in some cases, with a black hole. Now, there's a lot of debate about that. The massive black holes are very secure. There's not too much debate about whether they're really there. People have accepted that. The intermediate mass black holes, there's a lot of debate. Some people believe it, some people don't. A lot of work is going on. It's a very frontier area. But there's good evidence to think that there are black holes of that type. Now, stellar black holes, we have good evidence, several cases, very good evidence for stellar black holes. Stellar black holes form as a result of the explosion of a massive star. And we have a number of cases of black holes in binary systems of masses 5 to 10 times the mass of the sun. This is an image of data. This is a picture. This is, again, a visualization by an artist. A black hole down in there shining through accretion around the disk. We have good reason to think that stellar black holes exist. And when these two things form in binary systems, they will produce gravitational waves detectable by the ground-based detectors. So, the gravitational wave detectors, either on the drawing boards or in the field right now, will detect signals from black hole binaries. If we know what these signals look like, according to general relativity, what the prediction is, and then we make an observation of what the signals actually are, we will then be able to, we'll do a number of things. One of the things we'll be able to do is compare them with the general relativistic predictions and do a strong test of general relativity in a very, very strong regime of gravity. So here is a schematic of what a gravitational wave might look like. This is, and these are things I pulled off the web. These are not the sun in eclipse. There's meant to be a black hole here. They just tried to image it for you. And in a binary system, this is, an artist's conception on this page, orbiting around each other. It causes ripples in the curvature of space-time, seen here. If you have your detector over here, what are you going to see? Well, that wave comes by, up, down, up, down. That's what you see, the wave form. And so this is the wave form of the gravitational wave. Early on, of the binary system, early on, it's a simple sine wave, a sinusoid. as the binaries get closer together, the sine wave begins to increase in amplitude and in frequency. This is a type of signal that we're going to expect from a binary. Now, we've got the black holes in a binary orbiting around each other producing the nice waveform. When they get very, very close, those black holes will in fact merge into a single black hole. That is, there's an event horizon around each black hole. Those weird vacuum objects will actually come together and merge and form a single black hole around which there's a single event horizon, and in the process produce a very strong burst of gravitational waves. So here's another cartoon of what this looks like. This last stage of coalescence has three phases: in spiral, merger, and ring down. In spiral occurs when the black holes are far enough apart from each other that they're not distorting each other, they're just orbiting around and emitting waves. And this diagram, I call it the Kip diagram, was drawn originally by Kip Thorne to give you an idea of what's going on here. So these are these little black hole tornadoes spinning, emitting gravitational waves, and the waveform down here looks like the sinusoid increasing in frequency and amplitude. Fine. We know how to do that. We know how to calculate that analytically. We've known that for years. Now, they actually merge. They come together and something happens. What does the waveform look like? Don't know. This part can only be done numerically. It requires calculations on, in fact, very large computers, fairly ambitious project, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about in the rest of the lecture. So until recently, we have not known what this waveform looks like. And then the black hole forms. It's now a single distorted black hole. It rings down, emits its emits all of its non-axis symmetry in gravitational waves, and we know this last piece. This last piece is a damp sine wave. We know how to do this piece, the in-spiral. We know how to do the ring down. We need to do the merger. That's the goal. Is it a worthy goal? Yes. Not just because it keeps me employed, but which it does. It's a worthy goal because for various reasons. One of the reasons is that once we know that waveform, we can do a very strong test of general relativity. Another thing is that the luminosity of the merger phase is 10 to the 23 times the luminosity of the sun. That is, the energy that comes out in that merger phase there is more than the total energy output of all the stars in the visible universe. That's the biggest source, right? That makes a gamma ray burst look tiny. Okay? Now, you're not going to see it because it's gravitational waves. What's all that energy going to do? It's going to come and it's going to make Lisa move like that. Okay? So it's a high precision measurement. Now, talk a little bit about how we do these calculations. It's called numerical relativity. It's the enterprise in which we solve Einstein's equations on a computer. To do that, we have to undo that which Einstein did. Einstein put space and time together in a most beautiful way. If you're going to solve these equations numerically on a computer, you have to, unfortunately, deconstruct that. And you take space and time and you split it into space-like slices and curves of time that thread through those slices. You start out your binary on one of those slices, and then you evolve in the code, large computer code, accurately. And then you evolve that code from slice to slice by solving typically 17 or more coupled nonlinear partial differential equations. Did you notice how melodiously I said that? Okay. It's taken people more than 30 years to do that. Okay, so there's these big, hairy equations. If you know what those words mean, you know, wow, that's pretty big. And if you don't, you should go, wow, that's pretty big. Okay. So these are difficult equations to solve. They've got all kinds of instabilities. They've plagued us for decades. But that's the enterprise. That's what has to be done to get that map. Some subtleties. You mean to tell me we're going to put a black hole in a computer? Excuse me, doesn't a black hole have a singularity? Yes. So how do we deal with that singularity? Two stratagems. One is called excision. Black hole has a horizon around it. Nothing can get out, classically, can get out of that horizon. So why do you care what's inside that horizon? Cut it out of your grid. move your black hole, now a hole, around on your grid. That's called excision, and that's one way of solving this problem. It has a lot of problems with that, though. For years, people have had all kinds of instabilities. You have to put boundary conditions on your grid when you're going to do that. You have to move this patch around, a hole, a patch on the grid. When you do that, it's not trivial. Okay, that's one way of doing it. Another way is to say, well, okay, it was a singularity, but we're going to write that singularity in a simple form. We're going to write it as 1 over r, 1 over the radius distance. Singular, and we're going to take that singular piece, we're going to split it off, and we're going to evolve the rest. When we have to take a derivative or do something fancy with that singular piece, we're going to do it by hand properly, and then we're going to feed it to the code, and we're going to let the code do the rest of it. That's called the puncture method. Because you imagine the black hole, there's a puncture. All the nastiness is in this one point, the puncture. And then you deal with the nastiness analytically, and you evolve the rest. And that works really well, except that in order to do that, you can't move that puncture. The puncture has to be fixed in space. Okay, so two methods. Now, before I go any farther, let me tell you that we're going to use special units that my colleagues sometimes call God's units. I don't know if that's really true. All I know is that we're going to set C, the speed of light, and G, Newton's constant, equal to 1. And that gives us a beautiful simplicity. It means that we can measure everything, distance and time in particular, in terms of mass. So from now on, you will see all the graphs labeled M. M is the total mass of the system. So what's M? Well, it depends on what kind of a black hole you have. So 1M is 5 times 10 to the minus 6 M over M sun seconds. So if your black hole has 5 times 10 to the... If you have a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole pair, 1M is 5 seconds. Okay? If you have... And M is also equal... 1M is also 1.5 M over M sun kilometers. So in terms of distance, if you have a million solar mass black hole, 1M is 1.5 million kilometers. So this is a handy-dandy way of going back and forth. Just to give you an idea, for a massive black hole system that Lisa will see, how long does that merger last when it's 10 to the 23 times the luminosity of the sun? How long does it last? About an hour or so. For LIGO, for the LIGO, Virgo, Geo, the ground-based detectors, when the black holes are 5 to 10 solar masses, how long does that merger last? About a millisecond, tens of milliseconds. Okay? So luminosity is the same, but the duration is not. Brief history. I said this problem is an old problem. It is an old problem. Back in 1964, before John Wheeler coined the term black holes, Hahn and Lindquist tried to evolve the collision of two wormholes on the computer. They didn't get very far. Their computer program crashed. Now we know a little bit about why. They didn't know why, but this was a pioneering effort. They tried to do that. In the mid-1970s, Larry Smarr and Ken Epley came back to this problem. By now we had knowledge of black holes. We had a lot of theoretical work had been done. We had good observations indicating that there were indeed black holes in the universe. And the question of what happens when black holes merge came up again. This is, after all, in general relativity, this is the two-body problem. I mean, the black hole is, in some sense, the ultimate expression of vacuum energy. And now we're talking about a very fundamental interaction. What happens when there are two of them? In physics courses, that's the first thing you study in mechanics, is what happens when two-point particles interact. We have to be able to do it in general relativity. Still, you know, in the 70s, didn't know how to do it. So they started pioneering efforts on supercomputers, and they were actually able, with great duress, able to get two black holes to collide head-on and to extract the gravitational waves. Extract the gravitational waves means, imagine you have a detector here. What is that map? This was so hard, though, that going to the next step, where the black holes are orbiting and you're in a three-dimensional situation, proved to be very, very difficult. Throughout the 80s, there was very little work that went on. In the 1990s, though, LIGO got the nod from the National Science Foundation. We said, we're going to build this detector. We better get the simulations going so that we can find out what the signals are going to be. The National Science Foundation in the U.S. stepped up with a grand challenge, meaning read lots of grant money. And it became a multi-institutional, multi-year effort in 3D. Lots of people, almost the entire community joined in. And they found out that this is a very, very difficult problem. Codes were built. Codes crashed. It seemed as though the more they worked, the harder the codes crashed. After the National Science Foundation lasted about 5-6 years, the group split up, they went to their corners, and they kept working. It seemed as though the harder people worked, we're talking about smart people working very hard, the harder they worked, the worse it got. I'm saying that you got your black holes in the computer, they need to orbit around and merge, and you put your black holes here, and they go like that, and the code crashes. Why? Well, it turns out that the equations have instabilities in them. No matter, and people try different ways of writing the equations. This is called the formalisms. How do you write Einstein's equations? Write it this way, write it that way. And it turns out that in those equations, there are parasitic modes. That is, they're solutions to the equations. These are not numerical errors. They are solutions to the equations, but they are unphysical solutions to the equations. When you solve the quadratic equation, and you have to choose the physical solution, you use your intelligence to say, that's the right answer, this is the wrong answer, chuck it out. The computer doesn't know how to do that. The computer gets the right answers and the wrong answers, and the codes crash. This persisted for a long time. New groups started up. And by the year 2000 or so, young people, people whose ages begin with the number 2, were saying, yes, you're in trouble when the young people give up, right? We're saying numerical relativity is impossible. They're actually saying that this problem cannot be done. Well, not everybody believed that. New groups came up. Caltech formed one. Brownsville, we formed a group at NASA Goddard. And Jena in Germany, all over the world. And it's a good thing not everybody gave up. Because several years later, it turns out it was in December 2003, the first paper appeared. The achievement of the first actual black hole orbit. That was followed shortly thereafter by the first orbit merger and ring down. And today the field is wide open and the results are coming out at an incredible clip, and it's truly an astonishing time. So let me just go ahead and explain a little bit about these to you, some of the results. This is the first black hole binary orbit. This was achieved by the group in Jena. They used the puncture method. The puncture method is a traditional numerical relativity method. Most of the people in the world, how many people in the world do this work? 35 to 50, roughly. Okay. We're small but determined. Right? Now, I mean, you have to know general relativity, you have to be a theoretical physicist, and then you have to be willing to get your hands dirty and write these codes. So this is not, we don't have people swarming in to do this work. It's hard, and people failed repeatedly. And, how are you going to bring a graduate student into a field where you know that the likelihood is that the thesis isn't going to work? You have to have a certain attitude to do this work. So the group in Jena achieved the first complete binary black hole orbit using the traditional techniques, the punctures. Now, the punctures don't move, but the binary orbit. So what happens? That means the space-time moves around them. It's called co-moving coordinates, and the coordinates tend to get all tangled. They achieved an orbit. Their black holes went like this, and then the code crashed. Remember, what they were doing prior to this, they were doing that, and then the code crashed. These guys got it to go all the way around. This was the beginning of the breakthroughs. Okay? Shortly thereafter, Franz Pretorius, working with a completely different way, he has excised black holes. He was able to get his black holes. Now, his black holes move through space. They move around and around, and they merge, and these are the waves. There it is. That is the very first waveform ever calculated from the two-body problem in general relativity. Franz Pretorius. Now, you can see that there are several waveforms and they're lying on top of one another. Those are waves. So here's your system. They imagined a detector here, here, here. Because these are radiation fields, we know how they should behave. If we take all those signals and we shift them over to one location, they should all line up exactly. The fact that they don't line up exactly shows you that this was the first effort. By today's standard, these are primitive. But 2005, this was the first time anybody has seen anything, and the fidelity there for 2005 is very, very good. The frequency is high fidelity, the amplitude is not yet high fidelity. But this was the first look. Now, so when Franz came out with this, you better believe that people were saying, okay, Franz is the magic bullet. Franz knows how to do it. We know how to do it now. So many people in the community started retooling from the traditional methods to the Pretorius method. Except for our group, and the group at Brownsville. Our two groups, unbeknownst to each other, we're coming upon a different method. And this, in our group and the group at Brownsville, simultaneously hit upon the ability to move those puncture black holes. Remember I told you the black holes had to be fixed in the puncture method? Well, it turns out they don't. And we both discovered independently a simple but crucial way of handling the singular part that allows us to move our black holes. And let me tell you, when we found that, it worked. And we were in business in a big way. And it was just an amazing thing. This is called the moving puncture method. And was simultaneously discovered by these two groups. And I had organized a conference, because there was so much happening. I organized a conference at a Goddard in 2005, November 2005, the first week of November. And we had just gotten our results. We were just so ready to show everybody. Well, so, but since we're the host institution, I let the other people speak first. And they got up and, boy, they were so ready. And they showed their results. And we're going, did you tell them what we were doing? No. So you better believe that the rest of the community was aghast. Well, so then our group gets up. Dale, our postdoc, gets up. And he gives it. And then the Brownsville people are going, did you tell everybody? And it turns out that these two groups had discovered the same thing. And we're now doing waveforms. And how do you two? And so what was really, why this had such an impact was that it was a simple change to existing codes. And suddenly, when we put our papers out there, we put them on the archive preprint server, everybody in the world, the 35 to 50 people who were interested, you have to understand the audience, right? Read those, and anybody who had a traditional relativity code with these small set of instructions was suddenly in the game. So the leverage factor was enormous. So that was in November 2005. By April 2006, at the American Physical Society meeting, every year the American Physical Society meets in April, the general relativists go, and numerical relativists traditionally go there, meet in a very, very small, cramped room with barely a dim light bulb, and explain to each other why their codes are crashing. This is the tradition in the field, right? Well, this, in April 2006, let me tell you that that room was standing room only. And that we weren't talking about why the code was crashing. We had an entire session of results from black hole mergers. One of my colleagues who's not in this field of numerical relativity afterwards told me that he thought that that session contained the most significant physics developments at that meeting. This was quite a change. Since by the summer, there were still a few naysayers. By the summer, basically everybody else had pretty much gotten on board. The method was widely adopted. And now, since winter 2007, new results are just coming out almost weekly. And it's turned into a very, very active field with a lot of excitement. What's some of this excitement? Okay, well, this is some of the work. I'm just going to go through a few things. This is some of the work that our group did a year and a half ago. We wanted to know, what is that waveform? Now, Franz had gotten the waveform, but his black holes were very, very close together. So we had an idea of what the shape was. But what happens? Astrophysically, these black holes are going to spiral in from great distances and merge. So we did a series of simulations with the black holes here, 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 and here. At this point, now the codes, by the way, the codes don't crash anymore. Okay. What limits you now is the ability to get computer resources. Because you can run, our codes run on 500 to 1,000 processors anywhere from 24 to 72 hours. Okay. So no more crashing, that's over. So we did these simulations, and what we found was that the black holes lock on to trajectories. So here, look at this graph here. This is a plot of the distance between the black holes as a function of time. Now you can see that there are wiggles here. Astrophysically, we're doing much better than this now, but astrophysically this should be a nice simple curve just falling it together. Those wiggles are manifestations of eccentricity in the orbits. The orbits should be circular. But for various technical reasons, which I won't bore you with, we've had a hard time getting circular orbits. But it turns out that once the black holes get close enough together, they're attracted to a single solution. Now, there should only be one solution to this problem because it's an astrophysical problem with certain initial conditions. And indeed, when they're close enough together, they lock onto an attractor orbit. That orbit gives us a waveform, and this is what it looks like. And the little inset here, these are the four runs, blue, green, red, and black. And they kind of hiccup at the beginning, and then they get going with the waves. By the time the black holes get close together, you can see that the waveform has locked on. And we now have great confidence, in fact, that this is, in fact, what the black hole waveform is. Like I said, this is so 2006. We can do so much better than this. But I've only got a few moments to talk about this. Well, but is this the right answer? I mean, people actually said, well, Joe, how do you know that this is the right answer? What do you mean, how do you know this is the right answer? It's our code. Of course it's right. What about if you compare with other people? Okay, so while we were convinced, the outside world actually wanted to know if it was reproducible. So we got together with Campanelli, the Manuela Campanelli, the leader of the Brownsville group, and Franz Pretorius, and we compared our waveforms. Now, you will see that the black, which is our work, and the red, which is Campanelli's work, the waveforms lie right on top of one another. Our codes are similar enough that we were able to start out with the same initial conditions and run, and yes, we get the same waveform. Now, Pretorius's code, his initial conditions at the time had the black holes slightly spinning. They were co-rotating. They had small spin on them. The spin is going to distort the waveform a little bit. And in fact, we can calculate what that distortion should be over here in the ring down. And the difference between his results and ours is consistent with the existence of spin on his black holes. So this is, in fact, a very robust result. We've gone, like I said, beyond this now, but this was the first look and feeling that people really understood that these were, in fact, the right answers. Make some movies. Now, this is not an animation, folks. This is the solution. So these are the black hole surfaces. Now, this honeycomb stuff, these are contours of strong gravity. These are not radiative fields. They're contours of gravity. Now, as we zoom out, you can see those red curtains. Those are the waves. This is the gravitational waves coming out, and the black holes are going to merge. Boom, there they go. And that's the wave pattern coming out and the plus polarization. And we zoom back in, and we find a rotating black hole. Now, we should have put some little Coke bottle or something on that thing so that you could see it rotating around. But in fact, it is rotating around. And the contours show that. They're flattened. Let me show you the other polarization. So again, this honeycomb stuff is contour of gravity. It's not radiative. It's not a wave. But when they get far apart, when they get close together, you see the waves coming out. And you see this is a slightly different pattern because it's a different polarization. Boom. And you zoom back in. Okay. So I'm going to pause now before I finish for some reflection. This is a conference on science and faith, and I just want to talk to you a little bit about how I experience the interface between science and faith. I'm a practicing scientist. I'm not a philosopher. I'm a practicing scientist, and I'm also a practicing Christian. Now, I was raised in a church-going family. I was taught when I was young that God created the heavens and the earth, and I believed it, and I always did. I never walked away from that. As I began to learn about science and understand what science was and that I, too, could be a scientist, it always seemed quite natural to me, or as Alistair McGrath the other day said, resonant, it always seemed quite natural to me that God created it all and I would be studying what God created. And personally, I never had a problem with that. I never became an atheist. But I did have a problem with God. And so when I was in my, basically as soon as I could leave my church-going family, I walked away from the faith. This was due to a number of things, misunderstandings about legalism, misunderstandings about various kinds of things, and my own spirit of rebellion. I'm a feisty person, basically. And I set off, launched off into my life without God. Well, as the prodigal son did. Bad idea. And I won't bore or regale you with the details, but suffice it to say that I ended up with my life in a pretty big mess. As the prodigal did, came to his senses, I eventually did come to my senses. And thank God. And when I did come back, however, I found that the landscape of faith and religion was somewhat different from what, you know, when I was a child I had experienced. And in fact, there were a number of challenges that I experienced. I want to just tell you about two of these. When I did come to my senses and come back, as the prodigal did, I was at that time already an established scientist with grants and a research group, graduate students and all that. I'm in a field dominated by men. has always been in my history, though I wish it were not so. It is a fact. I walked into a scene, I walked into a world of Christianity in which women were not supposed to lead. Here I was, a woman, leading. I found it profoundly distressing to me to be marginalized and put down for being a woman and being a leader. It caused me a lot of turmoil, a lot of questioning of who I was and what my purpose for God was. It was very painful. Another aspect of my struggle was the role of how, the importance of my work as a scientist to God and to the Christian community. You have to understand that being a scientist is rather time-consuming. It takes a lot of effort. All of you all know that. Not science isn't the only thing that's time-consuming, but I'm just speaking from my own experience here. It takes a lot of my time. And I found myself in a religious landscape in which people were telling me that the only value of my work, which I was spending most of my time on, was to get money to give to people who were in full-time Christian service. This caused me a lot of pain and stress. You know, well, so should I stop and go, you know, hand out leaflets on the corner and then I would be working for God instead of being in the laboratory, in the computer? It's caused me a lot of conflict, as you might imagine. And sort of wrapping around with the leadership issue, I was also told, as I asked questions, well, what about this thing about me being a leader? You know, am I unholy? Am I, you know, whatever, the whore of Babylon or whatever? but you have to understand that some people will say things like that to you. What was my role as a leader here? I was told by someone that it didn't really matter that I led a research group because what really counted was in the church, and what I was leading wasn't in the church. So as you can see, these are some of the reasons I left, and I found out when I came back as the prodigal that some of these problems were still going on. God was very gracious, and over the years, it's been I think 19 years now, I have come across people, I've been in different churches, and people have come alongside me and helped me understand winnowing the truth from the false. And I've come to understand my calling, and I've come to understand that the work I do is important to God as a scientist. It does give me money, and I do give it to people who are missionaries. But the science I do is for the glory of God, discovering what God has created, and for the greater good. I actually believe the fact that we know how to do the two-body problem in general relativity is valuable. It may only be valuable to a small number of people in a practical sense, but I think that having that knowledge of what God has wrought is a valuable contribution, and I I'm grateful for that. And I just want to say that Alistair McGrath gave a beautiful talk the other night, and he gave us a challenge of how do we encourage young people, other people, and in particular young people, to come into this field of science and faith. And I think that in addition to the philosophical arguments, the very important philosophical questions that we need to consider, we also need to consider the kinds of things that I experience, because I know I am not the only one. And I know that women are not the only ones who experience these things too. So now, here I am, as a scientist and a Christian. I'm running a research group. Most of these people are young people. The next oldest person, we're just in the process of tenuring. We've got postdocs, we've got graduate students. We're in a very, very competitive field. How do I, as a Christian, live out stewardship, live out the gospel in my life? Like I said, I'm not a philosopher. I'm just a worker. But people said before that people leave the faith or they come to the faith because of how they interact with people, and that's where I have something to say or something to do. I find this a great challenge. I find it something that keeps me on my knees, and it keeps me humble for sure. Because I fail all the time. You love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. That sounds a lot to me like doing physics, but I know it's beyond that. And love your neighbor as yourself. You mean to tell me I have to love the Brownsville group? Or that group over there in Yana that's got more computing? Uh-huh. Yep, I do. How do I do that? To whom much is given, much is expected. I am one to whom much has been given, a lot. I have a lot of computer resources and a lot of other stuff. How do I, as a senior member of the community, keep my research group going, lead them. And remember, I can't just drop it all and boost another group. These people are depending upon me for their careers to go forward. I have to lead so they can get empowered. But I can't stomp on the rest of the community. Okay, so these are some real challenges. And for me, these are the big challenges. How do you empower these people? How do you give the people that are down in there doing the coding? We have a guy who emails me at 2 in the morning. You know, he's coding. How do we get him to be able to feel that he's being creative? How do we get him some of these awards? This award that I was given, when I was given it to me, I was very upset. I said to the people, I said, look, this award belongs to the group. And they said to me, without you, there would be no group. And I said, without the group, there would be no research. I was told that this award, and if you look in the NASA web pages, you will find that this award can only be given to an individual. So I was selected. But let me just ask you to contemplate what that says about what we think about science and how it's done and who should be rewarded. For heaven's sakes, they know going in it's a team effort, but they only award it to an individual. So these are some of the challenges that we have to face. In my struggles, in my work, I find the body of Christ meant for image to be very, very helpful. And we cannot do without one another. And I often am put in the position of the head. But I hope that I do it in a sense of stewardship. And it's something that's ever with me as a prayer. And I'm very grateful for the grace of prayer and the ever-presence of the Holy Spirit to help me in this. Because for me, these are where the serious issues and serious questions are.
Thank you so much.
I'm not done. I'm not done.
But it's a two more.
I'm not done. That was an interlude.
Okay.
Sorry, I do have a few more moments, and I wanted that to be an interlude. I want to go back to the story. Maybe I shouldn't have done it that way. Well, anyway, I did. So let me just say. The thing that's been a recoil, the thing that has really been very exciting this past 6-7 months has been what happens when black holes come together and the final black hole recoils. Now, if the black hole masses are not equal, when they come together, the gravitational radiation that comes out will be beamed preferentially in some direction. Okay. The gravitational waves carry energy and momentum in some direction. The remnant black hole gets kicked in the opposite direction. That's called a recoil or a remnant kick. To calculate that, this is very important astrophysically, because when the black holes come together, think about those merging black holes in the centers of galaxies. They come together and they suffer a recoil kick. How big is that kick? And can that kick send the black hole out of the galaxy? So this gets the news media's attention. Do you mean to tell me there's a billion solar mass black hole traveling through space? Maybe. And in order to find out, you have to do numerical relativity simulations. So we've done some of this work. Non-spinning black holes with unequal masses, the maximum kick that we can get is, this was found by the Jena group, they found the maximum kick is 176 kilometers a second. That's not very big. It's going to cause the black hole to be displaced a little bit, wobble around. Maybe we see the signature of that in some galaxies. But it's not very big. No danger of black holes leaving the galaxy. However, when the black holes are spinning, you can get larger kicks. And this started to come out in January of this year. When the spins are aligned or anti-aligned, the black holes merging, you can get kicks up to a couple hundred kilometers a second. 400 kilometers a second, 250 kilometers a second. That's pretty good. But not terribly dangerous. However, if the black hole spins are in the orbital plane, think about the planet Uranus. The planet Uranus is on its side orbiting the sun. If the black holes are like that, and they orbit together, and they merge, the kick that can result can be 2,000 kilometers a second or more. That baby is out of here. This was discovered by the Jena group, Titian Marinetti, Campanelli et al., Brownsville group in the action. Our group has done some of this work. This has been the big excitement over the past 6 months in this field. The astronomers are paying attention, right? Because this is going to tell us those black holes, those galaxies merge, the black holes get kicked out, the clusters merge. This is very interesting because it has a lot of astronomical implications. So here's a movie. This is a simulation. These are equal mass black holes starting out like that. You can see the rotation in this little barber pole striping that's painted on them. You can see now that the axes are precessing around. And they're going to merge. And here comes the final remnant. This black hole has a kick 1,500 kilometers a second in the positive Z direction. You can't see that here because even though it is happening, considering the size of the grid, it's actually a very, very small effect and it's not visible. So let me just give you now to actually conclude. Let me give you the status of the black hole merger simulations. Over the past couple of years, this field has experienced a huge burst of energy, a huge burst of progress. We now have impressive recent progress across a broad front. Many groups, everybody is in the game, lots of competition, healthy competition for the most part. Equal mass non-spinning black holes. We now have a good understanding of that system. Several groups have done this now. Several groups have run multiple orbits. And we have general agreement on the simple waveform shape and on how much energy is emitted in the last few cycles. So Einstein said E equals mc squared. Well, for gravitational waves, that m, the mass, is converted into gravitational waves, and they carry energy. How much energy? Well, anywhere from 3.5% to 4% of the total system mass is emitted in the last few cycles. That's where you get that 10 to the 23 times the solar luminosity number. That's a lot of energy. Long runs are possible, 7 orbits or more before merger. Gravitational wave data analysis applications are beginning. The LIGO people that are trying to detect these are hungry for our waveforms because now we've got the shape of what they're looking for. Very impressive work on the kicks. And so here's where we began. In spiral merger and ring down. Now this is the full case with spinning black holes, non-equal masses. We haven't got that completely pinned down yet. What we have, however, is done this. We've done the equal mass, non-spinning case well enough to now be certain that the waveform is that. It won't be long before I'd be able to stand up here before you and tell you what the general case looks like. And so I invite you all to please stay tuned. Now I'm done.
Thank you for that fascinating talk and all you've shared with us. I think there might be time for just maybe one quick question. Who will go for it? Because it is lunchtime. Yeah.
Just a question. Thank you very much for explaining a very difficult physics in such clear terms. Just a quick clarification point. The gravitational waves are quadrupole radiation,
right.
Is that about it?
Which means
it's not directional, you can see it in every direction, is that what that
it,
means?
So it comes out, right, it has a quadrupole antenna pattern, that's right.
Right.
So there's more radiation in some pattern, in some directions than there are in other directions, and there's some nulls.
There are nulls. And the other one is, how do we know that the speed is the speed of the gravitational waves go at the speed of
light? So that's a prediction of general relativity.
Okay.
That can actually be tested if you get high precision measurements. If it's not, so I showed you those waveforms. If the gravitational waves do not travel at the speed of light, there will be distortions in the wave patterns. And so when we have observations, we will be able to check to some degree how closely they are to the speed of light. It's a prediction.
Thank you. Well, there are one or two notices to come, so just stay with us. But in the meantime, let's give Joan a very big thank you for that excellent